Chapter 15. Gathering Darkness. The evening sun was a ball of blood on the treetops, casting a lurid light across the camp, a widely spaced sprawl of horse lines and canvas-covered wagons and high-wheeled carts and tents in every size and sort, with the snow between trampled to slush. Not the time of day or sort of place that Elenia wished to be on horseback. The smell of boiling beef wafting from the big black iron cook-pots was enough to turn her stomach. The cold air frosted her breath and promised a bitter night to come, and the wind cut through her best red cloak without regard for the thick lining of plush white fur. Snow Fox was supposed to be warmer than other furs, but she had never found it so. Holding the cloak closed with one gloved hand, she rode slowly and tried very hard, if not very successfully, not to shiver. Given the hour, it seemed more than likely she would be spending the night here, but as yet she had no idea where she would sleep. Doubtless in some lesser noble's tent, with the lord or lady shuffled off to find haven elsewhere and trying to put the best face on being evicted, but Aramella liked leaving her on tenterhooks until the very last, about beds and everything else. One suspense was no sooner dispelled than another replaced it. Plainly, the woman thought the constant uncertainty would make her squirm, perhaps even strive to please. That was far from the only miscalculation Aramella had made, beginning with the belief that Elenia Saran's claws had been clipped. She had just 4 men with the 2 golden boars on their cloaks as escort, and her maid, Janny, of course, huddling in her cloak till she seemed a bundle of green wool piled on her saddle. And she had not seen a single fellow more in the camp who she could be sure held a scrap of loyalty to Sarand. Here and there one of the clumps of men huddled around the campfires with their laundresses and seamstresses displayed House Anshar's red fox, and a double column of horsemen wearing Barin's winged hammer passed her heading in the opposite direction at a slow walk, hard-faced behind the bars of their helmets. They were of little real account in the long run. Carind and Lear had gotten singed badly by being slow when Morgaze took the throne. This time they would take Anshar and Barin wherever the advantage lay the instant they saw it clearly, abandoning Aramella with as great an alacrity as they had leapt to join her when the time came. Most of the men trudging through the muddy slush or peering hopefully into those disgusting cook-pots were levies, farmers and villagers gathered up when their lord or lady marched, and few wore any sort of house badge on their shabby coats and patched cloaks. Even separating putative soldiers from farriers and fletchers and the like was near impossible, since nearly all had belted on a sword of some description, or an axe. Light, a fair number of the women wore knives large enough to be called short swords, but there was no way to tell some conscripted farmer's wife from a wagon driver. They wore the same thick wool and had the same rough hands and weary faces. It did not really matter in any case. This winter siege was a dire mistake. The armsmen would begin going hungry long before the city did, but it gave Elenia an opportunity. And when an opening presented itself, you struck. Keeping her hood back far enough to show her features clearly in spite of the freezing wind, she nodded graciously to every unwashed lout who so much as looked in her direction, and ignored the surprised starts that some gave at her condescension. Most would remember her affability, remember the golden boars her escort wore, and know that Elenia Sarand had taken notice of them. On such a foundation, power was built. A high seat as much as a queen stood atop a tower built of people. True, those at the bottom were bricks of the basest clay, yet if those common bricks crumpled in their support, the tower fell. That was something Aramilla appeared to have forgotten, if she had ever known. Elenia doubted that Aramilla spoke to anyone lower than a steward or a personal servant. Had it been prudent, she herself would have passed a few words at every campfire, perhaps grasping a grubby hand now and then, remembering people she had encountered before, or at least dissembling well enough to make it seem she did. Pure and simple, Aramella lacked the wit to be queen. The camp covered more ground than most towns, more like 100 clustered camps of varying sizes than one, so she was free to wander without worrying too much about straying close to the outer boundaries, but she took a care anyway. The guards on sentry would be polite unless they were utter fools, yet without any doubt they had their orders. On principle, she approved of people doing as they were told, but it would be best to avoid any embarrassing incidents, especially given the likely consequences if Aramilla actually thought she had been trying to leave. She had already been forced to endure one frigid night sleeping in some soldier's filthy tent, a shelter hardly worth the name, complete with vermin and badly patched holes, not to mention the lack of Janny to help her with her clothes and add a little warmth under the sorry excuse for blankets, and that had been for no more than a perceived slight. Well, it had been an actual slight, but she had not thought Aramilla bright enough to catch it. Light! To think that she must step warily around that pea-brained ninny! Pulling her cloak closer, she tried to pretend that her shudder was just a reaction to the wind. There were better things to dwell on. More important things. She nodded to a wide-eyed young man with a dark scarf wrapped around his head, and he recoiled as though she had glared. Fool peasant. It was grating to think that only a few miles away that young chit Elaine sat snug and warm in the comfort of the royal palace, attended by scores of well-trained servants, and likely without two thoughts in her head beyond what to wear tonight at a supper prepared by the palace cooks. Rumor had the girl with child, possibly by some guardsman. It might be so. Elaine had never possessed any more sense of decency than her mother. Dailan was the brain there, a sharp mind, and dangerous notwithstanding her pathetic lack of ambition, perhaps advised by an Aes Sedai. There must be at least one real Aes Sedai among all those absurd rumors. So many fabulations drifted out of the city that telling reality from nonsense became difficult. Sea folk making holes in the air? Absolute drivel. Yet the White Tower clearly had an interest in putting one of its own on the throne. How could it not? Even so, Tar Valon seemed to be pragmatic when it came to these matters. History clearly showed that whoever reached the Lion Throne would soon find that she was the one the Tower actually had favored all along. The Aes Sedai would not lose their connection to Andor through a lack of nimbleness, particularly not with the Tower itself riven. Elaenia was as certain of that as she was of her own name. In fact, if half what she heard of the Tower's situation was true, the next Queen of Andor might find herself able to demand whatever she wanted in return for keeping that connection intact. In any event, no one was going to rest the rose crown on her head before summer at the earliest, and a great deal could change before then. A very great deal. She was making her second round of the camp when the sight of another small mounted party ahead of her, picking its slow way between the scattered campfires in the last light, made her scowl and draw rein sharply. The women were cloaked and deeply hooded, one in strong blue silk lined with black fur, the other in plain gray wool, but the silver triple keys worked large on the four armsmen's cloaks named them clearly enough. She could think of any number of people she would rather encounter than Nea Naron. In any case, while Aramilla had not precisely forbidden them to meet without her, Elaenia heard her teeth grind as much as felt them, and forced her face smooth. For the moment it seemed wisest not to press matters, especially when there seemed no possible advantage to such a meeting. Unfortunately, Nayan saw her before she could turn aside. The woman spoke hastily to her escort, and, while armsmen and maid were still bowing in their saddles, spurred toward Elaenia at a pace that sent clods of slush flying from her black gelding's hooves. The light burned the fool. On the other hand, whatever was goading Nayan to recklessness might be valuable to know, and dangerous not to. It might, but finding out presented its own dangers. "Stay here and remember that you've seen nothing," Elaenia snapped at her own meager retinue, and dug her heels into Dawn Wind's flanks without waiting for any reply. She had no need for elaborate bows and courtesies every time she turned around, not beyond what seemliness demanded, and her people knew better than to do anything other than what she commanded. It was everyone else she had to worry about, burn them all. As the long-legged bay sprang forward, she lost her grip on her cloak, and it streamed behind her like the crimson banner of Sarand. She refused to gather the cloak under control, flailing around in front of farmers and the light alone knew who, so the wind razored through her riding dress, another reason for irritation. Nayan at least had the sense to slow and meet her a little more than halfway, beside a pair of heavily laden carts with their empty shafts lying in the muck. The nearest fire was almost 20 paces away, and the nearest tents farther, their entry flaps laced tight against the cold. The men at the fire were intent on the big iron pot steaming over the flames, and if the stench from it was enough to make Alania want to empty her stomach, at least the wind that carried the stink would keep stray words from their ears. But they had better be important words. With a face as pale as ivory in its frame of black fur, Nayan might have been called beautiful by some, despite more than a hint of harshness around her mouth and eyes as cold as blue ice. Straight-backed and outwardly quite calm, she seemed untouched by events. Her breath, making a white mist, was steady and even. "Do you know where we are sleeping tonight, Elenia?" she said coolly. Elenia made no effort at all to stop from glaring. "Is that what you want?" Risking Aramilla's displeasure for a brainless question. The thought of risking Aramilla's displeasure, the thought that Aramilla's displeasure was something she needed to avoid, made her snarl. "You know as much as I, Nayan." Tugging at her reins, she was already turning her mount away when Nayan spoke again with just a hint of heat. "Don't play the simpleton with me, Elenia. And don't tell me you aren't as ready as I am to chew off your own foot to escape this trap. Now, can we at least pretend to civility?" Elenia kept Dawn Wind half turned away from the other woman and looked at her sideways, past the fur-trimmed edge of her hood. That way she could keep an eye on the men crowding around the nearest fire, too. No house badges displayed there. They could belong to anyone. Now and then one fellow or another, shielding bare hands in his armpits, glanced toward the two ladies on horseback, but their real interest was on shuffling near enough the fire to get warm. That, and how long it was going to take for the beef to boil down to something approaching mush. That sort seemed able to eat anything. "Do you think you can escape?" she asked quietly. Civility was all very well, but not at the expense of remaining here for all to see any longer than absolutely necessary. If Nayan saw a way out, though, how? The pledge you signed to support Marn has been posted across half of Andor by now. Besides, you can hardly think Aramilla will just allow you to ride away. Nayan flinched, and Elena could not help a tight smile. The woman was not so untouched as she feigned. She still managed to keep her voice level, though. "I saw Jared yesterday, Elenia, and even at a distance he looked like a thundercloud, galloping fit to break his mount's neck and his own. If I know your husband, he's already planning a way to cut you out of this. He would spit in the Dark One's eye for you." That was true, he would. "I'm sure you can see it would be best if I were part of those plans." "My husband signed the same pledge you did, Nayan, and he is an honorable man." He was too honorable for his own good in simple fact, but what Elenia wanted had been his guide since before their wedding vows. Jared had signed the pledge because she wrote and told him to, not that she had any choice as matters were, and he would even repudiate it, however reluctantly, if she were mad enough to ask it. Of course, there was the difficulty in letting him know what she did want at the moment. Aramilla was very careful not to let her within a mile of him. She had everything in hand, as far as she could in the circumstances, but she needed to let Jared know, if only to stop him from cutting her a way out. Spit in the Dark One's eye? He could take them both to ruin in the belief he was helping her, and he might do it, even knowing it meant their ruination. It required a great effort not to allow the frustration and fury suddenly welling up inside her to show on her face, but she covered the strain with a smile. She took considerable pride in being able to produce a smile for any situation. This one held a touch of surprise and a touch of disdain. "I'm not planning anything, Nayan, and neither is Jared, I'm sure. But if I were, why would I include you?" "Because if I am not included in those plans," Nayan said bluntly, "Aramilla might learn of them. She may be a blind fool, but she'll see once she's told where to look. And you might find yourself sharing a tent with your betrothed every night, not to mention protected by his armsmen." Elania's smile melted, but her voice turned to ice, matching the frozen ball that abruptly filled her stomach. "You want to be careful what you say, or Aramilla may ask her Tarabonner to play cat's cradle with you again. In truth, I think I can guarantee as much." It seemed impossible that Nayan's face could grow any whiter, yet it did. She actually swayed in her saddle and caught Elania's arm as if to keep from falling. A gust of wind flung her cloak about, and she let it flail. Those once cold eyes were quite wide now. The woman made no effort to hide her fear. Perhaps she was too far gone to be capable of hiding it. Her voice came breathy and panicked. "I know you and Jared are planning something, Elania. I know it. Take me with you, and I will pledge Aron to you as soon as I can be free of Aramilla." Oh, she was shaken to offer that. "Do you want to draw more attention than you already have?" Elania snapped, pulling free of the other woman's grasp. Dawn Wind and the Black Gelding danced nervously, catching their rider's moods, and Elania reined her bay hard to quiet him. Two of the men at the fire hurriedly put their heads down. No doubt they thought they saw two noblewomen arguing in the graying evening and wanted to attract no part of that anger on themselves. Yes, it must be only that. They might carry tales, but they knew better than to get mixed in their betters' arguments. "I have no plans to escape, none at all," she said in a quieter voice. Drawing her cloak close again, she calmly turned her head to check the carts and the nearest tents. If Nayan was frightened enough, when an opening presented itself. There was no one close enough to overhear, but she still kept her voice low. "Matters might change, of course. Who can say? If they do, I make you this promise. Under the light and by my hope of rebirth, I will not leave without you." A startled hope bloomed on Nayan's face. "Now to present the hook. If, that is, I have in my possession a letter written in your own hand, signed and sealed, in which you explicitly repudiate your support of Marn of your own free will and swear the support of House Aron to me for the throne, under the light and by your hope of rebirth, nothing less will do." Nayan's head jerked back, and she touched her lips with her tongue. Her eyes shifted as though searching for a way out, for help. The black continued to snort and dance, but she barely tightened her reins enough to keep him from bolting, and even that seemed unconscious. Yes, she was frightened, but not too frightened to know what Elania was demanding. The history of Andor contained too many examples for her not to know. A thousand possibilities remained so long as nothing was in writing, but the mere existence of such a letter would put a bit between Nayan's teeth and the reins in Elania's hands. Publication meant Nayan's destruction, unless Elania was fool enough to admit to coercion. She could try to hang on after that revelation, yet even a house with many fewer antagonisms between its members than Aron, many fewer cousins and aunts and uncles ready to undercut one another in a heartbeat, would still break apart. The lesser houses that had been tied to Aron for generations would seek protection elsewhere. In a matter of years, if not sooner, Nayan would be left as the high seat of a minor and discredited remnant. Oh yes, it had happened before. "We've been together long enough," Elania gathered her reins. "I wouldn't want to set tongues wagging. Perhaps we will have another chance to speak alone before Aramilla takes the throne." What a vile thought. "Perhaps." The other woman exhaled as if all of the breath in her body were leaking out, but Alania went on about turning her horse away, neither slowly nor in haste, not stopping until Nayan said urgently, "Wait!" Looking back over her shoulder, she did just that. Waited, without speaking a word. What needed to be said had been said. All that remained was to see whether the woman was desperate enough to deliver herself into Alania's hands. She should be. She had no Jared to work for her. In fact, anyone in Iran who suggested that Nayan needed rescuing likely would find herself imprisoned for thwarting Nayan's expressed will. Without Alania, she could grow old in captivity. With the letter, though, her captivity would be of a different kind. With the letter, Alania would be able to allow her every appearance of complete freedom. Apparently she was bright enough to see that. Or maybe just frightened enough of the Tarabonner. "I will get it to you as soon as I can," she said at last, in a resigned voice. "I look forward to seeing it," Alania murmured, barely bothering to mask her satisfaction. "But don't wait too long," she almost added, and just stopped herself. Nayan might be beaten, but a beaten foe could still put a knife in your back if goaded too far. Besides which, she feared Nayan's threat as much as Nayan feared hers, perhaps more. So long as Nayan did not know that, however, her blade had no point. As she rode back to her armsman, Elania's mood was more buoyant than it had been since, certainly since before her rescuers had turned out to be Aramilla's men. Perhaps since before Dailin had imprisoned her in Arangil in the first place, though she had never lost hope there. Her prison had been the governor's house, quite comfortable, even if she had to share an apartment with Nayan. Communicating with Jared certainly had presented no problem, and she thought she had made some inroads with the Queen's guards in Arangil. So many of them had been new come out of Cairn that they were unsure where their true loyalties lay. Now this wonderfully fortuitous encounter with Nayan lifted her spirits so much that she smiled at Janny and promised her a bevy of new dresses once they were inside Caemlyn, which produced a properly grateful smile from the plump-cheeked woman. Elania always bought new dresses for her maid when she felt particularly good, every one fine enough for a successful merchant. It was one way to ensure loyalty and discretion, and for 20 years Janny had delivered both. The sun was only a red rim above the trees now, and it was time to find Aramilla so she could be told where she was sleeping tonight. The light said it was a decent bed, in a warm tent that was not too smoky, with a decent meal beforehand. She could not ask more at present. Even that did not dent her mood, though. She not only nodded to the clusters of men and women they rode past, she smiled at them. She almost went so far as to wave. Matters were progressing better than they had in quite some time. Nayan was not simply disposed of as a rival for the throne. She had been leashed and brought to heel, or as good as. And that might, would, be sufficient to bring Karin and Lear. And there were those who would accept anyone other than another Trakand on the throne. Elorian, for one. Morghaz had had her flogged. Elorian would never stand for any Trakand. Aemlyn, Arathella, and Abella were possibilities, too, with their own grievances that could be exploited. Perhaps Pellivar or Luan as well. She had her feelers out. And she would not squander the advantage of Caemlyn, as that hoyden Elaine had. Historically, holding Caemlyn was enough to gather the support of at least 4 or 5 houses by itself. The timing would be key, certainly, or all the advantage would fall to Aramilla, but Elania could already see herself seated on the Lion Throne with the high seats kneeling to swear fealty. She already had her list of which high seats would need to be replaced. No one who had opposed her was going to be allowed to cause her trouble later. A series of unfortunate accidents would see to that. A pity she could not choose their replacements, but accidents could happen with incredible frequency. Her happy contemplation was shattered by the scrawny man who suddenly came up beside her on a stocky gray, his eyes feverishly bright in the fading light. For some reason, Nason had sprigs of green fur stuck in his thin white hair. It made him look as if he had been climbing in a tree, and his red silk coat and cloak were so worked with brightly colored flowers they could have passed for Ilioner carpets. He was ludicrous. He was also high seat of the most powerful single house in Andor, and he was quite mad. "Elania, my darling treasure," he brayed, spraying spittle. "How sweet the sight of you is to my eyes! You make honey seem stale and roses drab." Without need for conscious thought, she hastily reined Dawn Wind back and to the right, putting Janny's brown mare between her and him. "I'm not your betrothed, Nason," she snapped, seething at having to say that aloud for everyone to hear. "I am married, you old fool! Wait," she added, flinging up a hand. The imperative word and the gesture were for her armsmen, who had laid hands on sword hilts and were glaring at Nason. Some 30 or 40 men wearing House Caeran's sword and star were following the man, and they would not hesitate to cut down anyone they thought was threatening their high seat. Some already had blades half-drawn. They would not harm her, of course. Nason would have them hanged to a man if she was even bruised. Light, she did not know whether to laugh or cry over that. "Are you still afraid of that young oaf Jared?" Nason demanded, angling his mount to follow her. "He has no right to keep bothering you. The better man won, and he should acknowledge it. I'll challenge him." One hand, plainly bony even in its tight red glove, fumbled at a sword he probably had not drawn in 20 years. "I will cut him down like a dog for frightening you." Elania moved Dawn Wind deftly, so they described a circle around Janny, who murmured apologies to Nason and pretended to take her mare out of his way while getting in it. Mentally, Elania added a little embroidery to the dresses she would buy. Addle-pated as he was, Nason could go in a blink from honeyed words of courtly love to groping at her as if she were the lowest sort of tavern maid. That she could not endure, not again, certainly not in public. Circling, she forced a worried smile onto her face, though in truth the smile took more effort than the worry. If this old fool forced Jared to kill him, it would ruin everything. "You know I could not abide to have men fight over me, Nason." Her voice was breathy and anxious, but she did not try to control it. Breathy and anxious suited well enough. "How could I love a man with blood on his hands?" The ridiculous man frowned down that long nose till she began to wonder whether she had gone too far. He was mad as a spring hare, but not in everything, not always.
"I had not realized you were so sensitive," he said finally,
without stopping his effort to ride around Janny. His decrepit face brightened.
"But I should have known. I will remember from now on. Jared may live, so long as he doesn't pester you."
Abruptly he seemed to notice Janny for the first time, and with an irritated grimace he raised his hand high, balling it into a fist. The plump woman visibly steeled herself for the blow without moving aside, and Elania gritted her teeth. Silk embroidery. Definitely unsuitable for a maid, but Janny had earned it.
"Lord Nason, I have been looking for you everywhere," a woman's simpering voice cried, and the circling stopped.
Elania exhaled in relief as Aramilla rode up in the twilight with her entourage, and had to stifle a surge of fury at feeling relief. In over-elaborately embroidered green silk, with lace under her chin and at her wrists, Aramilla was plump verging on stout, with a vacuous smile and brown eyes that were always wide with affected interest, even when there was nothing to be interested in. Lacking the brains to tell the difference, she possessed just enough cunning to know there were things that should interest her, and she did not want anyone to think she had missed them. The only real concern she had was her own comfort and the income to ensure it. and the only reason she wanted the throne was that the royal coffers could provide greater comfort than the revenues of any high seat. Her entourage was larger than Nason's, though only half were armsmen wearing the four moons of her house. For the most part, hangers-on and sycophants made up the rest, lesser lords and ladies of minor houses and others willing to lick Aramilla's wrist for a place near power. She did love people to fawn over her. Nayan was there, too, on the edge of the group with her armsmen and maid, apparently cool-eyed and in control of herself once more, but keeping well away from Jacques Lunalt, a lean man with one of those farcical Tarabonner veils covering his huge moustaches, and a conical cap pushing the hood of his cloak to a ridiculous height. The fellow smiled too much as well. He hardly looked like a man who could reduce someone to begging with just a few cords. "Aramilla," Nason said in a confused tone, then frowned at his fist as if surprised to find it raised. Lowering his hand to the pommel of his saddle, he beamed a smile at the silly woman. "Aramilla, my dear," he said warmly. Not with the sort of warmth he often directed at Elenia. Somehow, it seemed, he had become at least half convinced that Aramilla was his daughter, and his favorite at that. Once, Elenia had heard him reminiscing at length with the woman about her mother, his last wife, dead nearly 30 years now. Aramilla managed to hold her end of the conversation, too, though she had never met Midella Cairn as far as Elenia knew. Still, despite all his fatherly smiles for Aramilla, his eyes sought through the shadowed crowd on horseback behind her, and his face relaxed when he found Sylvaise, his granddaughter and heir, a sturdy, placid young woman who met his gaze, unsmiling, then pulled her dark, fur-lined cowl well forward. She never smiled or frowned or showed any emotion at all that Elenia had ever detected, just kept an unvarying, cow-like expression. Plainly, she had a cow's wits, too. Aramilla kept Sylvaise closer than she did Elenia or Nayan, and so long as she did, there was no chance that Nason would be forced to retire from his honors. He was mad, assuredly, but sly. "I hope you're taking good care of my little Sylvaise, Aramilla," he murmured. "There are fortune hunters everywhere, and I want the darling girl kept safe." "Of course I am," Aramilla replied, brushing her overfed mare past Elenia without so much as a glance. Her tone was honey-sweet and sickeningly doting. "You know I'll keep her as safe as I keep myself." Smiling that empty-headed smile, she set about straightening Nason's cloak on his shoulders and smoothing it with the air of someone settling a shawl on a beloved invalid. "It's much too cold out for you. I know what you need. A warm tent and some hot spiced wine. I'll be happy to have my maid prepare it for you. Arlene, accompany Lord Nason to his tent and fix him some good spiced wine." A slim woman in her entourage gave a violent twitch, then rode forward slowly, pushing back the hood of her plain blue cloak to reveal a pretty face and a tremulous smile. Suddenly all those lickspittles and toad-eaters were adjusting their cloaks against the wind or snugging their gloves, looking anywhere except at Aramilla's maid. Especially the women. One of them could have been chosen as easily, and they knew it. Oddly, Sylvaise did not look away. It was impossible to see her face in the shadows of her hood, but the opening turned to follow the slender woman. Nason's grin showed his teeth, making him look even more like a goat than usual.
"Yes, yes, mulled wine would be good. Arlene, is it? Come, Arlene, there's a good girl. Not too chill, are you?"
The girl squeaked as he swept a corner of his cloak around her shoulders and gathered her so close she was leaning out of her saddle.
"You'll be warm in my tent, I promise."
Without so much as a glance back, he rode off at a walk, chortling and whispering at the young woman under his arm. His armsmen followed with the creak of leather and the slow, wet clop of hooves in the muck. One of them laughed, as if another had said something funny. Elenia shook her head in disgust. Pushing a pretty woman in front of Nason to distract him was one thing. She did not even have to be that pretty. Any woman the old fool could corner was in danger. But using your own maid was revolting. Not as revolting as Nason himself, though. "You promised to keep him away from me, Aramilla," she said in a low, tight voice. That lecherous old crackbrain might have forgotten her existence for the moment, but he would remember the next time he saw her. "You promised to keep him occupied." Aramilla's face grew sullen, and she petulantly tugged her riding gloves tighter. She had not gotten what she wanted. That was a great sin to her. "If you want to be safe from admirers, you ought to stay close to me instead of wandering about loose. Can I help it if you attract men? And I did rescue you. I haven't heard any thanks for that." Elenia's jaw clenched so hard that it began to ache. Pretending that she supported this woman of her own choice was enough to make her want to bite something. Her choices had been made clear enough. Write to Jared, or endure an extended honeymoon with her betrothed. Light. She might have taken the choice if not for the certainty that Nason would lock her up in some out-of-the-way manner, and after she had put up with his pawing, eventually forget she was there, and leave her there. Aramilla insisted on the pretense, though. She insisted on a great many things, some of them utterly insufferable. Yet they had to be suffered, for the time being. Perhaps, once matters were set straight, Master Lunalt could offer his attentions to Aramilla for a few days. From somewhere she summoned an apologetic smile and made herself bend her neck as if she were one of the bootlicking leeches who were watching her avidly. After all, if she crawled for Aramilla, it only proved they were right, too. The feel of their eyes on her made her want to bathe. Doing this in front of Nayan made her want to shriek. "I offer you all the gratitude that's in me, Aramilla." Well, that was no lie. All the gratitude that was in her came about equal to a desire to strangle the other woman very slowly. She had to inhale deeply before she could get the next part out, though. "You must forgive me for being slow, please. A very bitter word. Nason made me quite distraught. You know how Jared would react if he learned of Nason's behavior." Her own voice took on a honed edge at that last, but the fool woman giggled. She giggled. "Of course you're forgiven, Elenia," she laughed, her face lightening. "All you need do is ask. Jared is a hothead, isn't he? You must write to him and tell him how content you are. You are content, aren't you? You can dictate to my secretary. I do hate staining my fingers with ink, don't you?" "Certainly I'm content, Aramilla. How could I not be?" Smiling required no effort at all this time. The woman actually thought she was clever. Using Aramilla's secretary precluded any possibility of secret inks, but she could tell Jared quite openly to do absolutely nothing without her counsel, and the brainless fluff would think she was only obeying. Nodding with a smug self-satisfaction, Aramilla gathered her reins, imitated by her coterie. If she stuck a pot on her head and called it a hat, they would all wear pots, too. "It is getting late," she said, "and I want an early start in the morning. Adela Baron's cook has an excellent repast waiting on us. You and Nayan must ride with me, Elenia." She made it sound as though she were honoring them, and they had no choice except to behave as though she were, falling in on either side of her. "And Sylvaise, of course. Come, Sylvaise." Nason's granddaughter brought her mare closer, but not up beside Aramilla. She followed a little behind, with Aramilla's sycophants crowding on her heels since they had not been invited to ride with Aramilla. Despite the fitful icy wind tugging at their cloaks, several of the women and two or three of the men tried unsuccessfully to engage the girl in conversation. She seldom said two words together. Still, with no high seat in reach to fawn over, a high seat's heir would do, and maybe one of the fellows hoped to marry well. Likely one or two were more in the nature of guards, or at least spies, making sure she did not try to communicate with anyone in her house. This lot would find that exciting, touching on the edges of power. Elenia had her own plans for Sylvaes. Aramilla was another with no objections to nattering away when anyone with sense would be muffling herself in her cowl, and her chatter as they rode through the dying light flitted from what Lear's sister would offer at supper to the plans for her coronation. Elenia listened only enough to murmur approvingly at what seemed appropriate spots. If the fool wanted to offer a sworn amnesty to those who opposed her, far be it from Elenia Sarant to tell her she was a fool. It was painful enough having to simper at the woman without listening to her. Then one thing Aramilla said hit her ear like an awl.
"You and Nayan won't mind sharing a bed, will you? It seems we are short of decent tents here."
She flitted on, but for a moment Elenia could not hear a word. She felt as though her skin had been stuffed with snow. Turning her head slightly, she met Nayan's shocked gaze. There was no possible way Aramilla could know about their chance meeting, not yet. And even if she did, why would she offer them a chance to plot together? A trap? Spies to listen to what they said? Nayan's maid? Or Janny? The world seemed to spin. Black and silver flecks floated in front of Elenia's eyes. She thought she was about to faint. Abruptly, she realized that Aramilla had addressed something to her directly and was waiting on an answer with an increasingly impatient scowl. Frantically, she cast her mind about. Yes, she had it. A gilded coach, Aramilla? What a ridiculous notion. As well ride in a tinker's wagon. Oh, delightful! You do have such marvelous ideas. Aramilla's pleased simper put a little ease into Elenia's breathing. The woman was a brainless fool. Maybe there was a shortage of suitable tents. More likely, she just thought they were safe now, tamed. Elenia turned her bared teeth into a simper of her own. But she put aside any idea of having the Taraboner entertain the woman, even for an hour. With Jared's signature on that pledge, there was only one way to clear her path to the throne. Everything was in hand and ready to go forward. The only question was whether Aramilla or Nason should die first.
Night pressed down on Camelin with a hard cold, driven by sharp winds. Here and there a glow of light spilling from an upper window spoke of people still awake, but most shutters were drawn, and a thin sliver of moon low in the sky only seemed to emphasize the darkness. Even the snow-coating rooftops and piled along the fronts of buildings, where it had escaped the day's traffic, was a shadowy gray. The lone man, muffled head to ankles in a dark cloak, striding through the frozen slush left on the paving stones, answered to David Hanlon or Doylan Millar with equal ease. A name was no more than a coat, and a man changed his coat whenever needed. He had worn a number over the years. Given his wishes, he would have had his feet up in front of a roaring fire in the royal palace, a mug in his hand, a pitcher of brandy at his side, and a willing wench on his knee. But he had others' wishes to serve. At least the footing was better here in the new city. Not good, with this frozen muck underfoot that could turn a careless step into a sprawl. Yet a man's boots were less likely to go out from under him here than back on the steeper hills of the inner city. Besides, darkness suited him tonight. There had been few people in the streets when he started out, and the number had dwindled away as darkness deepened. Wise people stayed indoors once night fell. Occasionally, dim shapes skulked in the deeper shadows, but after a brief study of Hanlon, they scuttled around corners ahead of him or withdrew into alleys trying to muffle their curses as they floundered in snow that likely had not been touched by the sun. He was not bulky and little taller than the average run of men, with his sword and breastplate hidden by his cloak to boot. But footpads looked for weakness of hesitation, and he moved with an obvious self-confidence, plainly unafraid of lurkers, an attitude helped by the long dagger concealed in his gauntleted right hand. He kept an eye out for patrols of guardsmen as he walked, but he did not expect to see any. The strong arms and prowlers would have sought other hunting grounds if the guards were about. Of course, he could send nosy guardsmen on their way with a word, yet he wanted no observers of any kind, and no questions why he was so far from the palace afoot. His step hesitated as two heavily cloaked women appeared at a crossing well ahead, but they moved on without glancing his way, and he breathed more easily. Very few women would venture out at this time of night without a man along to wield sword or cudgel, and even without seeing their faces he would have wagered a fistful of gold to a horse-apple. That pair were Aes Sedai. Or else some of those strange women who filled most of the beds in the palace. The thought of that lot brought a scowl and a prickling between his shoulder blades like the brush of nettles. Whatever was going on in the palace, it was enough to give him the grips. The sea folk women were bad enough, and not just because they went swaying along the halls in that seductive way, then pulled a knife on a man. He had not even thought of patting one on the bottom after he realized they and the Aes Sedai were staring at one another like strange cats in a box. And plainly, however impossibly, the sea folk were the larger cats. The others were worse, in a way. No matter what the rumors said, he knew the look of Aes Sedai, and it did not include wrinkles. Yet some of them could channel, and he had the disturbing notion that they all could, which made no sense at all. Maybe the sea folk had some sort of peculiar dispensation, but as for these kin, as Felian called them, everyone knew that if three women who could channel and were not Aes Sedai sat down at the same table, Aes Sedai would appear before they could finish a pitcher of wine and tell them to move on and never speak to one another again. And make sure they did it, besides. That was given. But there those women sat in the palace, over 100 of them, holding their private meetings, walking around Aes Sedai without one frown between them. Until today, anyway. And whatever had set them huddling like frightened hens, the Aes Sedai had been every bit as anxious. There were too many oddities to suit him. When Aes Sedai behaved oddly, it was time for a man to look to the safety of his own skin. With a curse, he jerked himself out of his reverie. A man needed to look out for his skin in the night, too, and letting his concentration drift was no way to do it. At least he had not stopped or even slowed. After a few more steps, he smiled a thin smile and thumbed the blade of his dagger. The wind sighed down the street and fell, whistled across rooftops and fell, and in the brief silences between, he could hear the faint crunch of the boots that had been following him since shortly after he left the palace. At the next crossing street, he turned to his right at the same steady, unhurried pace, then suddenly flattened his back against the front of a stable that stood hard on the corner. The wide stable doors were shut and likely barred on the inside, but the smell of horse and horse dung hung in the icy air. The inn across the street was closed up tight as well, its windows shuttered and dark, the only sound aside from the wind, the creak of its swinging sign he could not make out in the night. No one to see what they should not. He had a moment's warning, the sound of boots quickened in an effort not to let him out of sight too long, and then a cowled head was thrust cautiously around the corner. Not cautiously enough, of course. His left hand darted into the cowl to seize a throat at the same time his right made a practiced stop thrust with a dagger. He half expected to find a breastplate or a mail shirt under the man's coat, and he was ready if he did. But an inch of steel sank easily beneath the fellow's breastbone. He did not know why that seemed to paralyze a man's lungs, so he could not cry out until he had drowned in his own blood, but he knew that it did. Still, tonight he had no time to wait. No guards inside at present did not mean matters would stay that way for long. With a quick wrench, he slammed the man's head against the stable's stone wall, hard enough to crack a skull, then shoved his dagger to the hilt, feeling the blade grate as it dug through the fellow's spine. His breathing remained steady. Killing was just a thing that had to be done now and again, nothing to get excited over. But he hurriedly lowered the corpse to the snow against the wall and crouched beside it, wiping his blade on the dead man's dark coat, while sticking his other hand into his armpit to tuck off his steel-backed gauntlet. Head swiveling, he watched the street both ways as he felt quickly across the man's face in the darkness. A rasp of stubble under his fingers told him that it was a man, but no more. Man, woman, or child made no difference to him. Fools behaved as though children had no eyes to see or tongues to tell what they saw, yet he wished there had been a mustache or a bulbous nose, anything to spark a memory and tell him who this fellow had been. A squeeze at the dead man's sleeve found thick wool, neither fine nor particularly rough, and a sinewy arm that could have belonged to clerk or wagon driver or footman. To any man, in short, just like the coat. Searching down the body, he rifled through the fellow's pockets, finding a wooden comb and a ball of twine, which he tossed aside. At the man's belt, his hand paused. A leather sheath hung there, empty. No man on earth could have drawn a dagger after Hanlon's blade found his lungs. Of course, there was good cause for a man to carry his knife unsheathed when he walked out at night, but the reason that came most readily to mind right then was to stab someone in the back or cut a throat. It was only a fleeting pause, though. Wasting no time on speculation, he sliced off the fellow's purse beneath the drawstrings. The weight of the coins he spilled into his hand and hastily stuffed into his own pocket told him there was no gold, likely not even a piece of silver. But a cut purse and no coins would make whoever found the body think him the prey of strong arms. Straightening, he tugged on his gauntlet, and only moments after driving his blade home, he was striding along the slush-covered pavement once more, dagger held close to his side beneath his cloak and eyes wary. He did not relax until he was a street away from the dead man, and then he did not relax very far. Most people who heard of the killing would accept the tale of murder for theft that he had laid out for them, but not whoever had sent the fellow. Following all the way from the palace meant that he had been sent, but by whom? He was fairly sure that any of the sea folk who wanted a knife put in him would have done the deed herself. For all that the kin troubled him just by being there, they seemed to keep quiet and walk small. True, people who practiced avoiding notice were the most likely to resort to a hired knife in the night, but he had never exchanged more than 3 words at a time with any of them, and he certainly had never tried to finger one. The Aes Sedai seemed more likely, yet he was sure he had done nothing to rouse their suspicions. Still, any one of them might have her own reasons for wanting him dead. You could never tell with Aes Sedai. Birgitta Trehelion was a silly bint who seemed to think she really was a character out of a story, maybe even the real Birgitta, if there had ever been a real Birgitta, but she could well think he was a threat to her position. She might be a strumpet, wiggling around the corridors in those trousers the way she did, yet she had a cold eye. That one could order a throat slit without blinking. The last possibility was the one that worried him most, though. His own masters were not the most trusting of people, and not always the most trustworthy. And the Lady Cheyenne Avarin, who currently gave him his orders, was the one who had sent a summons that had pulled him into the night, where a fellow just happened to be waiting to follow him, knife in hand. He did not believe in coincidence, no matter what people said about this Althor. Thoughts of turning back to the palace came and went in a flash. He had gold tucked away. He could bribe his way through the gates as easily as anyone else, or just order one opened long enough to let him ride out. But it would mean spending the rest of his life watching his back, and anyone who came inside arm's length of him might be the one sent to kill him. Not so different from the way he lived now. Except for the certainty that someone would put poison in his cup or a knife through his ribs sooner or later. Besides, that stone-eyed troll Birgitta was the most likely culprit, or an Aes Sedai. Or maybe he had offended these kin somehow. Still, it always paid to be careful. His fingers flexed around the dagger's hilt. Life was good at the moment, with plenty of comfort and plenty of women impressed or frightened into compliance by a captain of the guards. But life on the run was always preferable to death here and now. Finding the correct street, much less the correct house, was not easy. One narrow side street looked very like another when darkness swathed both. But he took a care and eventually found himself pounding on the front doors of a tall, shadowed pile that could have belonged to a wealthy but discreet merchant. Except he knew now that it did not. Avarin was a tiny house, extinct, some said, but one daughter of it remained, and Cheyenne possessed money. One of the doors swung open, and he flung up a hand against the sudden glare of light. His left hand, the dagger in his right, he kept concealed and ready. Squinting through his spread fingers, he recognized the woman at the door, in the plain dark dress of a maid. Not that that eased his mind by a hair. "Give us a kiss, Felian," he said as he stepped inside. Leering, he reached for her, left-handed, of course. The long-faced woman brushed his hand aside and shut the door firmly behind him. "Cheyenne is closeted with a visitor in the front sitting room upstairs," she said calmly, "and the cook is in her bedchamber. There is no one else in the house. Hang your cloak on the rack. I will let her know you are here, but you may have to wait." Hanlon let his leer vanish and his hand drop. For all of her ageless face, handsome was the best that Felian could be called, and even that might be stretching the truth, with her cold gaze and a cold manner in the bargain. She was hardly the sort of woman he would have chosen to fondle, but it seemed she was being punished by one of the chosen, and he was supposed to be part of the punishment, which altered matters. To some extent. Tumbling a woman who had no choice had never troubled him, and Felian certainly had none. Her maid's dress was simple truth. She did the work of four or five women by herself, maids and scullions and spitgirl, sleeping when she could, and truckling whenever Cheyenne frowned. Her hands were rough and red from doing laundry and scrubbing floors. Yet she was likely to survive her punishment, and the last thing he wanted was an Aes Sedai with a personal grudge against David Hanlon. Not when circumstances might well change before he had an opportunity to put a knife through her heart, anyway. Reaching an accommodation with her had been easy, though. She seemed to have a practical view. When others could see, he rumpled her every time she came in reach, and when there was time, he bundled her up to her tiny maid's room under the eaves. Where they mussed the bedclothes, then sat on the narrow bed in the cold and exchanged information. Though at her urging, he did give her a few bruises, just in case Cheyenne chose to check. He hoped she remembered that it was at her urging. "Where are the others?" he said, swinging his cloak off and hanging it on the leopard-carved cloak rack. The sound of his boots on the floor tiles bounced from the entry hall's high ceiling. It was a fine space, with painted plaster cornices and several rich wall hangings on carved panels that were polished to a faint glow, well lit by mirrored stand lamps with enough gilding for the royal palace itself, but burn him if it was much warmer than outside. Felian raised an eyebrow at the dagger in his hand, and he sheathed it with a tight smile. He could have it out again faster than anyone would believe, and his sword near as fast. "The streets are full of thieves at night." Despite the chill, he removed his gauntlets and tucked them behind his sword belt. Anything else might make it appear he thought himself in danger. The breastplate should be enough anyway, come the worst. "I do not know where Marilyn is," she said over her shoulder, already turning away and gathering her skirts for the stair steps. "She went out before sunset. Marilyn is in the stables with his pipe. We can talk after I inform Cheyenne you've arrived." Watching her climb the stairs, he grunted. Marilyn, a hulking fellow Hanlon did not like at his back, was banished to the stables behind the house whenever he wanted to smoke his pipe, because Cheyenne disliked the smell of the rough tobacco he used. And since he usually took a pot of ale with him, or even a pitcher, he should not be coming in any time soon. Marilyn worried him more. She was Aes Sedai, too, apparently as much under Cheyenne's orders as Felian, or himself. But he had no agreements with her. No arguments, either, yet he distrusted any Aes Sedai on principle, Black Aja or not. Where had she gone? To do what? What a man did not know could kill him, and Marilyn Gimolfin spent entirely too much time off doing things he knew nothing about. He was coming to the conclusion that there were entirely too many things in Camelin he knew nothing about. Past time he learned, if he wanted to live. With Felian gone, he went from the icy entry hall straight to the kitchen at the back of the house. The brick-walled room was empty, of course. The cook knew better than to poke her nose out of a room in the basement once she was sent away for the night. And the black iron stove and the ovens stood cold, but a small blaze in the long stone hearth made the kitchen one of the few rooms in the house that would be warm. Compared to the rest, at least. Cheyenne was a stingy woman, except when it came to her own comforts. The fire here was only in case she happened to want mulled wine in the night, or a heated egg milk. He had been in this house above half a dozen times since coming to Camelin, and he knew which cabinets held the spices and which room off the kitchen always held a cask of wine. Always good wine. Cheyenne never stinted there, not with that she intended to drink herself anyway. By the time Felian returned, he had the honey pot and a dish of ginger and cloves sitting on the wide kitchen table with a pitcher full of wine and a poker thrust into the fire. Cheyenne might say, "come now," and mean now, but when she wanted a man to wait, it could be near daylight before she saw him. These calls always cost him sleep, burn the woman. "Who is the visitor?" he asked.
"He gave no name, not to me," Felian said, propping the door to the hall open with a chair. That let some of the sparse warmth leak out, but she would want to be able to hear if Cheyenne summoned her. Or maybe she wanted to make sure the other woman was not able to eavesdrop. "A lean man, tall and hard, with the look of a soldier. An officer of some rank, maybe a noble by his manner, an Andoran by his accents. He seems intelligent and cautious, His clothes are quite plain, though costly, and he wears no rings or pins. Frowning at the table, she turned to one of the tall open front cabinets beside the door to the hallway and added a second pewter cup to the one he had set out for himself. It had never occurred to him to set out two. Bad enough he had to fix his own wine. Aes Sedai or no Aes Sedai, she was the maid. But she took a chair at the table and pushed the dish of spices away from her, for all the world as though she expected him to serve. Cheyenne had two visitors yesterday, however, more careless than this fellow, she went on. One, in the morning, had the golden boars of Sarand on the cuff of his gauntlets. He probably thought no one would notice small work, if he thought at all. A plump yellow-haired man in his middle years, who looked down his nose at everything, complimented the wine as though surprised to find a decent vintage in the house, and wanted Cheyenne to have me beaten for showing insufficient respect. She said even that in a cold, measured voice. The only time she had had any heat in her was when Cheyenne put the strap to her. He had heard her howl right enough then. A countryman who has seldom been to Camelin, but believes he knows how his betters behave, I should say. You can mark him by a wart on his chin and a small half-moon scar beside his left eye. The fellow in the afternoon was short and dark, with a sharp nose and wary eyes, and no scars or marks I could see, though he wore a ring with a square garnet on his left hand. He was sparing with words, very mindful to give away nothing in the little I heard, but he carried a dagger with the four moons of House Marn on the pommel. Folding his arms, Hanlon leaned against the side of the fireplace and kept his face smooth despite a desire to scowl. He had been sure that the plan was for Elaine to take the throne, though what came after remained a mystery. She had been promised to him as a queen. Whether or not she wore a crown when he took her mattered not a whit to him, except for the spice it added. Breaking that long-legged bit to saddle would be pure pleasure if she had been a farmer's daughter, especially after the chit cut a slice off him today in front of all those other women. But dealings with Sarand and Marn said maybe Elaine was meant to die uncrowned. Maybe, in spite of all the promises that he could romp a queen, he had been placed where he was, so he could kill her at some selected moment, when her death would bring some specific result sought by Cheyenne. Or rather, by the chosen who had given her her orders. Moradin, the fellow was called, a name Hanlon had never heard before coming to this house. That did not trouble him. If a man had the nerve to call himself one of the chosen, Hanlon was not fool enough to question it. The likelihood that he was no more than a dagger in this did not trouble him. So long as a dagger did the job, what matter if it broke in the doing? Much better to be the fist on the hilt than the blade. "Did you see any gold change hands?" he asked. "Did you hear anything?" "I would have said," she replied thinly. "And by our agreement, it is my turn for a question." He managed to mask his irritation behind an expectant look. The fool woman always asked about the Aes Sedai in the palace, or those she called the kin, or about the sea folk. Silly questions. Who was friendly with whom, and who unfriendly? Who exchanged private words, and who avoided one another? What he had heard them say, as if he had nothing to do with his time but lurk around the hallways spying on them. He never lied to her. There was too much chance she might learn the truth, even mired here in this house as a maid. She was Aes Sedai, after all. But it was growing difficult to come up with something he had not already told her, and she was adamant that he give information if he expected to receive any. Still, he had a few tidbits to offer today, some of the sea folk going off, and the whole lot of them jumping for most of the day as if they had icicles shoved down their backs. She would have to settle for that. What he needed to know was important, not bloody gossip. Before she could get her question out, though, the door to the outside opened. Morellin was large enough that he almost filled the doorway, yet icy cold still swirled in, a gust that made the small fire dance and sent sparks flying up the chimney until the big man pushed the door shut. He gave no sign that he felt the chill, but then his brown coat looked thick as two cloaks. Besides, the man was not only the size of an ox, he had the wits of one. Setting a tall wooden mug down on the table with a thump, he tucked his thumbs behind his wide belt and eyed Hanlon resentfully. "You messing with my woman?" he muttered. Hanlon gave a start. Not from any fear of Morellin, not with the oaf on the other side of the table. What startled him was the Aes Sedai leaping from her chair and snatching up the wine pitcher. Dumping in the ginger and cloves, she added a scoop of honey and swirled the pitcher around as if that was going to mix everything, then used a fold of her skirt to pull the poker from the fire and shove it into the wine without checking to see whether it was hot enough yet. She never looked in Morellan's direction at all. "Your woman?" Hanlon said carefully. That earned a smirk from the other man.
"Near enough. The lady figured I might as well use what you aren't. Anyway, Fally and me keep each other warm nights."
Morellan started around the table, still grinning, but at the woman now. A shout echoed in the hallway, and he stopped with a sigh, his grin fading.
"Felian,"
Cheyenne's distant voice called sharply.
"Bring Helen up now and be quick about it."
Felian set the pitcher on the table hard enough to slop wine over the rim and was heading for the door before Cheyenne finished. When the other woman spoke, Felian jumped. Hanlon jumped too, if for a different reason. Catching up to her, he seized her arm as she took the first step on the stairs. A quick glance back showed the kitchen door closed. Maybe Morellan did feel the cold. He kept his voice low anyway. What was that all about? "It's none of your business," she said curtly. "Can you get me something that will make him sleep? Something I can put in his ale or wine? He will drink anything, however it tastes. If Cheyenne thinks I'm disobeying orders, it bloody well is my business. And you ought to see it that way, too, if you have two bloody thoughts to rub together." She tilted her head, staring down that long nose at him, cold as a fish. "This has nothing to do with you. As far as Cheyenne is concerned, I will still belong to you when you are here. You see, certain matters changed." Suddenly, something unseen grasped his wrist tightly and pulled his hand from her sleeve. Something else latched onto his throat, squeezing till he could not draw breath. Futilely, he scrabbled left-handed for his dagger. Her tone remained cool. "I thought certain other matters should change accordingly. But Cheyenne does not see things logically. She says that when the great Master Moradin wishes my punishment lessened, he will say so. Moradin gave me to her. Morellan is her way of making sure I understand that. Her way of making sure I know that I am her dog, until she says otherwise." Abruptly, she drew a deep breath, and the pressure vanished from his wrist and throat. Air had never tasted so sweet. "You can get what I ask for," she said, as calm as if she had not just tried to kill him with the bloody power. Just the thought that that had been touching him made his skin crawl.
"I can't,"
he began hoarsely, and stopped to swallow, rubbing at his throat. It felt as though it had been cinched in a hangman's noose.
"I can get you something that will put him in a sleep he'll never wake from."
As soon as it was safe, he was going to gutter like a goose. She snorted derisively. "I would be the first Cheyenne suspected, and I might as well cut my own wrists as object to anything she decided to do. It will be enough if he sleeps the nights through. Leave the thinking to me, and we will both be the better for it." Resting a hand on the carved newel post, she glanced up the stairs. "Come. When she says now, she means now." A pity he could not hang her up like a goose to wait for the knife. Following her, his boots thumped on the treads, sending a clatter through the entry hall, and it struck him that he had not heard the visitor leave. Unless the house had some secret way out he did not know, there was only the front door, the one in the kitchen, and a second at the back that could only be reached by passing the kitchen. So it seemed he was to meet this soldier. Maybe it was supposed to come as a surprise. Surreptitiously, he eased his dagger in its sheath. As expected, the front sitting room had a fine blaze burning away in the wide fireplace of blue-veined marble. It was a room worth the looting, with seafolk porcelain vases on the gilt-edged side tables, and tapestries and carpets that would fetch a pretty price. Except that one of the carpets was likely worthless now. A low blanket-covered mound lay near the middle of the room, and if the fellow that made it had not stained the carpet with his blood, Hanlon would eat the boots sticking out from one end. Cheyenne herself was sitting in a carved armchair, a pretty woman, in gold-embroidered blue silk with an ornate belt of woven gold and a heavy gold necklace around her slim neck. Glossy brown hair hung below her shoulders, even caught in a net of intricate lace. She looked delicate at first glance, but there was something vulpine about her face, and her smile never touched those big brown eyes. She was using a lace-edged handkerchief to clean a small dagger capped with a fire drop on the pommel. "Go tell Morellen that I will have a bundle for him to dispose of later, Phelion," she said calmly. Phelion's face remained smooth as polished marble, but she made a curtsy that lacked little of cringing before she scuttled out of the room at a run. Watching the woman and her dagger from the corner of his eye, Hanlon moved to the covered mound and bent to lift a corner of the blanket. Glazed blue eyes stared out of a face that might have been hard alive. The dead always looked softer. Apparently, he had been neither as cautious nor as intelligent as Phelion thought him. Hanlon let the blanket fall and straightened. "He said something you objected to, my lady," he said mildly. "Who was he?"
"He said several things I objected to."
She held her dagger up, studying the small blade to be sure it was clean, then slid it into a gold-worked sheath at her waist.
"Tell me, is Elaine's child yours?"
"I don't know who fathered the whelp," he said wryly. "Why, m'lady, do you think I'd go soft? The last chit who claimed I'd gotten a child on her, I stuffed her down a well to cool her head and made sure she stayed there." There were a long-necked silver wine pitcher and two chased silver cups sitting on a tray on one of the side tables. "Is this safe?" he asked, peering into the cups. Both had wine in the bottom, but a little addition to one would have turned the dead man into easy prey.
"Catrell Mosnay, an ironmonger's daughter from Meyron," the woman said, just as smoothly as if it were common knowledge, and he very nearly flinched in surprise. "You split her head open with a rock before you pitched her down, no doubt to spare her drowning." How did she know the wench's name, much less about the rock? He had not remembered her name himself. "No, I doubt you would go soft, but I would hate to think you were kissing the Lady Elaine without letting me know. I would purely hate that."
Suddenly she frowned at the blood-stained handkerchief in her hand, and rose gracefully to glide to the fireplace and toss it into the flames. She stood there warming herself, never even glancing in his direction.
"Can you arrange for some of the Seanchan women to escape? Best if it can be both those called Suldam and the ones called Damani."
She stumbled a little over the strange words.
"But if you can't do both, then a few of the Suldam should do. They will free some of the others."
"Maybe." Blood and bloody ashes, she was dancing from one thing to another worse than Phelion tonight.
"It won't be easy, m'lady. They're all guarded close."
"I didn't ask whether it would be easy," she said, staring into the flames. "Can you shift guards away from the food warehouses? It would please me if some of those actually burned. I am tired of attempts that always fail."
"That I cannot do," he muttered. "Not unless you expect me to go into hiding right after. They keep a record of orders that would make a Carianan wince. And it wouldn't do any good anyway, now with those bloody gateways bringing in more wagons every bloody day."
In truth, he was not sorry for that. Queasy over the means used, certainly, but not sorry. He expected the palace would be the last place in Camelon to go hungry in any case, but he had lived out sieges on both sides of the lines, and he had no intention of ever boiling his boots for soup again. Cheyenne wanted fires, though.
"Another answer I did not ask for."
She shook her head, still looking into the fireplace, not at him.
"But perhaps something can be done there. How close are you to actually enjoying Elaine's affections?" she finished primly.
"Closer than the day I arrived in the palace," he growled, glowering at her back.
He tried never to offend those the Chosen had set above him, but the chit was trying him. He could snap that slender neck like a twig. To keep his hands from her throat, he filled one of the cups and held it with no intention of drinking. In his left hand, of course. Just because there was one dead man in the room already did not mean she had no plans to make it two corpses.
"But I have to go slow. It isn't as if I can back her into a corner and tickle her out of her shift."
"I suppose not,"
Cheyenne said in a muffled voice.
She is hardly the sort of woman you are used to.
Was she laughing? Was she amused at him?
It was all I could do not to throw down the wine cup and strangle the fox-faced Bint.
Suddenly she turned around, and he blinked as she casually slipped her dagger back into its sheath. He had never seen her draw the bloody thing. He took a swallow of wine without thinking, and almost choked when he realized what he had done.
"How would you like to see Camelin looted?" she asked.
"Well enough, if I have a good company at my back and a clear path to the gates." The wine had to be safe. Two cups meant she had drunk two, and if he had picked up the dead man's, there could not be enough poison left in it to sicken a mouse.
"Is that what you want? I follow orders as well as the next man."
He did when he seemed likely to survive them, or when they came from the Chosen. As well die for a fool as disobey the Chosen.
"But sometimes it helps to know more than go there and do that. If you told me what you're after here in Camelin, I might be able to help you reach it faster."
"Of course."
She smiled a toothy smile, while her eyes stayed as flat as brown stones.
"But first, tell me why there is fresh blood on your gauntlet."
He smiled back.
"A footpad who got unlucky, m'lady. Maybe she had sent the man, and maybe not. But he added her throat to the list of those he intended to slit. And he might as well add Marilyn Gamalfin, too. After all, a lone survivor was the only one who could tell the tale of what had happened."